Welcome to episode one of the Aerospace Advantage podcast, brought to you by the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. I'm your host, retired Lieutenant Colonel John Baum, and you may call me by my tactical call sign, Slick. Today, we're going to explore the importance of aerospace power in an era where threats are on the rise. And to tackle those threats head on, our nation is going to need smart options. Aerospace power will continue to be the smart option on demand by our top elected officials, commanders fighting the wars, and the men and women on the front lines. 100 years of history have proven aerospace power is what is needed to affect the battle space. Simply put, right now, our nation is facing a new and ominous security environment to the likes that we have never seen before. And no course of action is going to succeed without leveraging aerospace power. That's going to be an air, space, and cyberspace. On this podcast, we're going to elaborate on these domains and how we are going to affect the nation's future wars by leveraging the aerospace advantage. Before we begin, however, you might be wondering, who is this guy, Slick Baum? So here's a quick rundown on me. I proudly joined the Air Force when I was 17 years old, and I began my career as an avionics technician. It didn't take me long to realize that I want to become an Air Force officer, so I used my GI Bill, earned a commission, and took the oath for a second time, serving as a fighter pilot and retiring after nearly 23 years of service. During my time as a fighter pilot, I flew in combat zones over Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I also deployed to the Pacific in response to the rising threat in the region. I scrambled my F-16 Viper in defense of the homeland under Operation Noble Eagle. I humbly served as an instructor at the Air Force Weapons School. That's the Air Force version of Top Gun for those that are unaware of the Air Force Weapons School. And I also flew across North America and Asia as a pilot on the famous demonstration team, the Air Force Thunderbirds. I spent some time out of the cockpit where I served as a strategic communication fellow and also as a requirements officer in the Pentagon working on a program called NGAD. That's the Next Generation Air Dominance Platform and the associated weapons along with it. In the military, a platform is the equipment a soldier uses in a fight. So for airmen, the NGAD platform means the next generation and the most advanced airplane or airframe within the U.S. inventory. I've got to say that throughout my career in the military, I have gained a tremendous appreciation for what aerospace power does for our country. I have a deep respect, of course, for the men and women that I served alongside and that continue to serve us today. They come from all walks of life, as you know, and they sacrifice so much to serve me and you. And many of you know that these airmen serve under the harshest conditions, sometimes without sufficient resources, but they always serve our nation with distinction. So when the Mitchell Institute asked me to host this podcast, I jumped at the opportunity because, frankly, I'm a believer. I believe in aerospace power and what it does for our nation. But I think we also needed a platform that goes beyond, you know, the normal recruiting ads and Rotary Club type speeches. And we want to involve you, the audience. We want you to be our wingman. We want you to join us and explore these topics that are of such great importance to the nation's security, because together we're going to investigate the challenges that face the Air Force and the newest service, the U.S. Space Force, and of course, the industrial base that innovates, develops, and manufactures the tools and systems needed to stay ahead and stay on the leading edge of aerospace power. So we hope you're going to enjoy the people, the conversations, the war stories, the forecasts, the history, and the perspectives as you and I learn about our aerospace nation and maintain the aerospace advantage. So with that, let's begin with this thesis. Military aerospace capabilities will be the quintessential element addressing today and tomorrow's national security challenges. We know this. Aerospace power will be called upon, and we better be ready when the nation calls us to do it. It's going to require some work given today's state of play. So despite the storied history of the United States Air Force, it is facing tremendous challenges. Right now, we know that the Air Force aircraft inventories are too small, too old, and too fragile. And the newly established Space Force is an unfunded mandate. This service was created without enough budget resource increase, given the duties that we're asking of it to do. And both of these services are likely to see a funding decline due to the economic impact of COVID-19. But at the same time, the demand for aerospace power is increasing in ways that the nation hasn't seen in decades because of peer competitors like China and Russia. They are challenging our very advantages that we've painstakingly built over the last few decades. Now, all of this isn't being said for the sake of being negative. We're really trying to point out why we feel, for those of us that are in this business, that the Air Force is really weak on the ground. Let me give you some examples, okay? The United States Air Force has a bomber fleet where two-thirds of it was acquired before the Kennedy administration came to power. Our tanker fleet has our current pilots flying tail numbers that their grandfathers and fathers flew. And the fighter fleet that we're going to go to war with today has an average age of over 25 years old. This is not a winning hand. On top of this, the Air Force is about half of the size it used to be during the Cold War. So we have a smaller force flying old airplanes, and they're being run harder because we have demands across the globe. All of these things are a recipe for how we see the Air Force becoming broken. This is how you get shot down in war, and this is how, frankly, you lose a war. I can cite similar statistics for the assets that we have in orbit for our Space Force. All of this needs to change. Now, the 20th Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Mark Welsh, sounded the alarm to Congress in January of 2015. He testified in front of Senator John McCain at the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he laid this out on the line.
We currently have 12 fleets of airplanes that qualify for antique license plates in the state of Virginia. We must modernize our Air Force. We want to work with you to do it within our top line. It certainly won't be easy, and it will require accepting prudent operational risk in some mission areas for a time. But the option of not modernizing really isn't an option at all. Air forces that fall behind technology fail. And joint forces that don't have the breadth of the airspace and cyber capabilities that comprise modern air power will lose.
All right. Now, despite General Welsh's warning, the situation has remained relatively unchanged. The next 3 years, General Welsh's successor, General Goldfein, put his challenge in context.
One of the most important statements in the National Defense Strategy is the acknowledgement that America's military has no preordained right to victory on the battlefield. As our predecessors did before us, victory must be planned for, properly resourced, trained for aggressively, fought for, and eventually won in the unforgiving crucible of combat. The Air Force we need.
Now, this is why he and then Secretary of the Air Force Heather Wilson laid forth the requirement to size the service not on what they could afford, but what they needed.
As Secretary Wilson laid out yesterday, our 312 operational squadrons today, moving forward to 386, form the boxer's fist. They remain the fundamental fighting formation of the Air Force.
So the difference in the numbers that they spoke about, 386 squadrons needed versus 312 squadrons that were funded, it meant that there was a huge shortfall in resources to meet the demands that the nation was placing on the Air Force. In the world of strategy and planning, this type of shortage reflects a risk. And the bigger the shortage, the higher the risk. The risk of failure and the ability to deter war, and of course, it also means failure during war. So, in this case, General Welsh, General Goldfein, and Secretary Wilson made it clear to Congress that they needed more funding, that they were facing severe risk if they continued to neglect the imperative to resource the men and women who will be asked to fly in a harm's way when the chips are down. Now in 2020, the picture largely remains the same. The only difference is the challenges are now shared by two services, the United States Air Force and the newly minted Space Force. The dilemmas faced by the Air Force are only projected to worsen. But the new Air Force Chief of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, launched his tenure with a new vision termed Accelerate Change or Lose.
You know, the world is changing. We're in a very dynamic environment. We're taking various actions in response. And so we're changing. And we have a window of opportunity. A window of opportunity to change, to control and exploit the air domain to the standard our nation expects and requires from its Air Force. If we don't change, if we fail to adapt, we risk losing. We risk losing in a great power competition, risk losing in a high-end fight, risk losing quality airmen, losing budget dollars, our credibility, and aspects of our national security.
Space Force Chief of Space Operations, General Jay Raymond, made a similar call for change and quickly.
We are on the cusp of a tectonic shift in warfare. Access to space can no longer be assumed. It must be underpinned by strength. And if deterrence fails, I am convinced that the next major conflict with a peer competitor will be won or lost in space. In order to be ready, for the conflict, we must be bold, we must innovate, and we must move, and we must think faster. And we must empower and leverage the outstanding talent that we have in this room and around the force.
As expected by the American people, Air and Space Force leaders must anticipate tomorrow's challenges to ensure aerospace power evolves, not only to keep pace, but to win. So the bottom line, the zone the military was in for the last 20 years, this zone of relative dominance and freedom of action, it's changed drastically. The old approaches will not survive in an emerging security environment. Guys, gone are the days of the status quo and assumed air supremacy. But what is the nature of Chief Brown's call to accelerate change or lose? What needs to change? And does it all need to change? General Deptula, the Dean of the Mitchell Institute, looks in the rearview mirror to describe the scope of this kind of change.
We can no longer indulge in the luxury of being an unchallenged superpower. To put it frankly, this assumption took us down a dangerous path, one that yielded the smallest and oldest Air Force in history. Think about it. Most members of the military, our schools, technological innovations, structures, and organizations are a product of 30 years of relatively permissive operations. No one today really knows the horror of losing a division of soldiers, of aircraft carriers being sunk after a missile attack, mass aircraft attrition, persistent denial of space-based capabilities, or crippling cyber attacks. We really haven't had to deal with our logistics under attack since World War II. We operate task force headquarters and concentrated facilities within the strike range of advanced adversary missiles. We buy brand new copies of old aircraft designs that are wholly unsurvivable against modern enemy air defenses. We have bases in the Pacific and Europe with no air and missile defenses. Is this unbelievable? No, that's the reality right now. We are a product of where we've been, and that place is now gone forever. All of this needs to change and change fast. General Brown has the right sight picture. The one thing that doesn't change is the importance of aerospace power. Nothing else works without it, period, dot.
Thank you, General Deptula. And of course, as we are going to highlight on the aerospace advantage, is the fact that things must change, and that's what we're here to discuss. During our first few episodes, we're going to set the scene regarding the current state of play around the world. And then our regular sortie rhythm will explore topics on where aerospace power is going and the underlying reasons why. Without any further delay, let's begin at the foundation. What exactly is aerospace power? My first guest is Doug Berkey, the Executive Director at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. Doug, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast.
Hey, Slick. I just want to let you know how much all of us here at Mitchell really appreciate you leading our newest initiative. You know, this is something that we've kicked around for a long time. You and I have talked about it. But if you think about the intersection of where we are in the security environment, really where aerospace technology is, this is a really fantastic time to get this rolling. And so really appreciate your time in making this happen.
Well, Doug, it is my pleasure, and I'm truly humbled to be at the helm of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. So thank you.
Now, you know, look, man, whether discussing your time as a weapons school instructor, as experience as a combat pilot, what you bring is an incredible firsthand perspective that's second to none. And that is so important to have that direct credibility and just insight. You see things that the rest of us aren't going to, and that's really going to help increase the value here, what we're able to afford our listeners. And so I'm also sure there's some folks out there going to want to hear about your time as a Thunderbird. Ascots are always in season fashion, I hear, and especially around the holidays, will keep you nice and warm there. But seriously, man, you've got a great career with aerospace, and I don't think the chapters have all been written. Your recent acquisition of a 1944 Stearman is going to certainly set up a future vector here for some great adventures in that vein. So again, from all of us, thanks so much for doing this.
Well, absolutely, Doug, and thanks for the words. You know, I definitely feel a huge responsibility as a steward of that Stearman to preserve, you know, that historical perspective from an aerospace beginning. And we'll definitely talk about flying in combat and maybe a little bit about loops to music during the podcast series. But let's get serious and start today's discussion by breaking down the need for aerospace power. When we think about warfare, people tend to think of the masses of armies that have met on the battlefield and fought throughout histories. The Navy was right there too. In the past century, we've had access to these domains of air and space, and that's just a sliver of time in human history. And in that time, we have seen a radical technological evolution, which has fundamentally altered how we project military power. So let me ask you, Doug, what exactly is aerospace power and how does it come into play in today's wars?
Yeah, when I think about the subject of this episode, and really explaining the underpinnings of what aerospace power is, I'd emphasize that it's not just about aircraft or spacecraft, tactics or technology. Really, the heart of it comes down to a mindset. And this is where airmen and space professionals, they harness their respective domains to secure national security interests in the most effective, efficient fashion possible. And they're often doing this in ways wholly unavailable by any other means. And that's really where the aerospace domain is fundamentally different from land or sea.
I see, Doug. So strategically, how are air and space domains different?
Well, surface forces, they got to approach things in a linear sequential fashion. So, you know, think of it this way. They're at point A, the objective is at point B, and so they've got to fight their way through an adversary that's in between. And so much of their time and energy is focused on going through that terrain at speeds that really haven't changed much in the last several decades, if not centuries. For them, it's a game of feet and miles. Now, air and space power is different because we can fly over hostile forces, and we can see the entire battle space, and we can target the things that matter most, not just what lies over the next hill. And this means we can strike the very center of our adversary's war efforts on day one. And we can do this really fast, in a matter of minutes and hours. And this drives an entirely different way of thinking, one that is very strategic and focused, and what we call effects-based. And by that, I mean focusing on what allows an adversary to continue the fight. And, you know, without getting too bogged down here, think about it this way, in your everyday life, it's a difference between flying from D.C. to L.A. versus a week-long road trip on the same path. I mean, one is all about you get in the plane and you're there in a couple hours and you're on with business. The other is this week-long sequential travail across the country. And you look, you get to the same destination, but it's a radically different opportunity cost time-wise.
Doug, this is why I love talking to you about this subject. So tell me more about the background here. You know, where did this type of thinking start and how did it develop?
Yeah, let me give you some concrete examples here past the platitudes. The origins of this thinking extend back to World War I. And this is where airmen observed the bloody, stagnant trench lines. You know, they looked down from above. They looked and saw soldiers. They're charging into fire over and over again. And the results are obvious. It was total decimation. You know the deal. This sort of fighting wiped out a generation. You know, these airmen, they also recognized that they had in their hands a game-changing opportunity. They realized that they could fly over opposing lines and strike the very heart of what sustained the enemy's combat operations. Things like command and control centers, production facilities, weapons depots, and logistics lines. You know, you deprive an enemy of those assets, and they, I don't care how strong they are, can endure for very long. And so for traditional ground units, reaching those kind of targets would require slogging hundreds of miles through hostile terrain. They're going to risk countless lives in the process. And the difference between aerospace and surface-based strategy all comes down to a very simple precept in many ways. For a given amount of force, what action would yield the greatest result?
Right. So what happened after that?
Yeah. Well, airmen spent the next two decades after World War I, and they were really dedicated to this quest, and they thought, you know, about this strategically, operationally, tactically, and technologically. And I'm going to add one more layer onto this. I think they had a moral imperative. They saw the carnage with their buddies in World War I dying at catastrophic levels, and they were utterly convinced at the most core level that they had to find a better way. And they really saw this glimmer of hope through the air power realm. And so that's where they're pioneering missions like strategic bombing, air superiority, close air support, air transport, and even what would later be known as Air Force Special Operations. And so after years of advocating for these concepts in the abstract, they put their theories to the test in World War II. And by that time, these were senior air commanders. And so another thing to their credit is their vision sometimes outpaced available technology, but they kept pushing forward and they kept learning from pragmatic experience. And if it didn't work quite right, you know, with the initial concept, they adjusted rapidly. And you got to give credit to those guys that they didn't get stuck in dogmatic beliefs and just keep hammering away on a given vector. They're very agile, and that's very important. So for anyone questioning the results of their efforts, it's really important to consider that 11 months transpired between the D-Day invasion of June 6, 1944, and the Allies' entry into Berlin in May of 1945, you know, when forces literally rolled across the same ground that previously saw 4 years of static combat, and they did this in a matter of days and weeks if you look at certain regions of France where the trench lines had originally been. And the crucial difference between the two wars, World War I and World War II, is the predominance of air power. You know, the German war machine was destroyed through countless bombing raids, and the sky was controlled by young fighter pilots. And past that, consider the bombing of Japan that yielded the country's surrender without an invasion of the home islands. That's unprecedented. Nothing like that had ever happened before. And air power was the key reason there.
Well, absolutely. And World War II obviously changed the game when air power fundamentally reshaped military power projection.
Now you bet. Warfare never looked the same.
All right, Doug. So after World War II, what came next?
Well, in the years after World War II, air power provided leaders with unique options to secure their goals. And this was all about not triggering World War III. You know, they did not want to escalate things to levels that were uncontrollable and just be cataclysmic. And so let me give you an example here. The Berlin airlift in 1948, this is where air mobility provided a vital third option. So you've got West Berlin, it's cut off by Soviet forces. We can't get food or other necessary supplies in there. And so we're really in a bad spot here. And so the Allied nations really had a stark choice. They could either attack Soviet forces to open a channel of access to West Berlin, or they could have surrendered the region. Now, these are both really bad choices, but air power provided that vital third way by going over, not through. And this isn't the only example like that. Air power also kept base elsewhere in the Cold War with, you know, look at the nuclear triad of bombers, missiles that were deterring the Soviet Union. That whole notion of peace through strength that worked there. And this is also the era of the Cold War where the military space operations entered the picture. You know, space professionals really came into the fold in the fields of reconnaissance, communications, weather, and missile launch warning systems. You know, their ability to own the ultimate high ground afforded tremendous opportunities wholly unavailable in the past. Programs like the Corona spy satellites proved vital when the shootdown of Francis Gary Powers and his U-2 precluded further direct overflights of the Soviet Union. And that it's a whole other dimension to how we can really be rapid and effects focused in ways that we couldn't even imagine before. And these guys really, they took advantage of it in tremendous ways.
Absolutely, Doug. You know, I think about the stand-up of the Space Force in 2019, but airmen have been involved in space since the 1950s, as you mentioned. So I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about our space professionals here on the Aerospace Advantage. But getting back to this, what are some more modern examples of how aerospace innovations increase U.S. warfighting capabilities?
Yeah, if you want to answer this question, it really begins with Desert Storm. You know, this is often unappreciated and perceived as a quick blip in history, but the exact opposite is true. This conflict ushered in a new approach, netting strategic results in a rapid, decisive fashion. You know, in the wake of what was an 8-year-long, extremely brutal Iran-Iraq war, as contrast, you know, U.S. commanders, they really wanted to avoid falling into a similar struggle. And they did that through harnessing strategic air power. So U.S. and coalition forces were able to disrupt the Iraqi regime's ability to function. Iraqi leadership couldn't communicate with fielded forces. Important installations are destroyed and combat units are pummeled from the sky. And so if you look at it, this is a month and a half long air campaign, and there was just 100 hours of ground fighting at the very end of the conflict, and that saw the U.S. and its allies secure victory. It's tremendously different than Iran-Iraq war, which is more like World War I. And it also saw air power theory finally match technological capability, and this is a big deal. You know, prior to Desert Storm, naysayers could always criticize air power as failing to meet, you know, the projections, the promises. And that changed in 1991. It was largely due to developments regarding stealth and precision weapons. It saw massive gains regarding the ability to project focus power on really important objectives without high risk of getting shot down. And so for a historical comparison, one F-117 with a load of two smart bombs literally bested the results of a 1,000-plane bomber raid of World War II and at far less risk. And one bomb, one target became a new reality that embodied the original intent of the air power pioneers. And this wasn't a one-off. Air power's positive impact was put to the test in the skies over Bosnia and Kosovo, and it proved critical during the initial phases of Operation Enduring Freedom over Afghanistan and Operation Iraqi Freedom. And the results were overwhelmingly positive. In fact, the asymmetric advantages afforded by air power became so obvious and were so important, yet appeared easy, that people began to take it for granted. Now, there's a lot more to this story, but we'll get to that later.
So, Doug, the key takeaway for me in your discussion is the fact that aerospace power is a mindset, and the airmen have the ability to look at a problem set differently. So it's not just about planes or satellites. It's about how the nation uses these tools to protect the homeland and protect America's interests around the globe.
As we continue to build this podcast, we're not only going to talk about the Air Force and Space Force core missions and challenges, we're also going to focus on the opportunities, the new warfighting concepts, new technologies, and all these things that make aerospace power a reality. Whether it's the space experts controlling satellite constellations above, the role of unmanned aerial vehicles, fifth generation fighters and bombers, or how things like artificial intelligence and machine learning are playing into the equation. We're also going to talk about people. All of this comes down to people, the people making decisions to press ahead. And I want to emphasize that even though my roots are in the Air Force as a fighter pilot, we are going to pay special attention to the space power front. We're going to take a lot of time to engage with Space Force leaders and operators as they chart out the next chapter in this key domain. I mean, there's not really anything more exciting to talk about than developing a new Space Force. So let's take this time to reflect back on General Deptula's comments from our leadoff today. Let's talk about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because tomorrow's contests are going to be far harder and different. We've gotten way too used to operating in uncontested environments. And air and space assets have enjoyed the ability to freely move about the battle space with ease. This is no longer a sound assumption. While we've certainly innovated over the last 20 years, it's important to point out that we are looking at a very narrow slice of the operating environment, and we need to open our aperture. The bottom line from this podcast is our major competitors, they are nations who hold undue sway in the world, like China and Russia. They continue to build their military capability and capacity, and their worldview is far different than ours. They seek to challenge us. The proof is obvious. Whether you think about China and you watch them grabbing swaths of international territory in the Pacific, engaging in highly aggressive cyber attacks, or grabbing control of places like Hong Kong, and Russia's not far behind, invading Ukraine, having a scorched earth type warfare in Syria, or seeking to undermine our citizens' faith in democracy through sophisticated information operations. These threats are serious, and aerospace power will be key in drawing credible lines and sticking to them. Another key part of the Aerospace Advantage podcast involves talking to today's air and space leaders. They balance these challenges each and every day. And here's what they had to say about the future of aerospace power and the role their airmen and space professionals bring to the fight. Here's Admiral Charles Richard, commander of U.S. Strategic Command, the organization who oversees our strategic nuclear capabilities.
The threat is significant. I'm only going to highlight the strategic forces a piece of this. But remember, strategic deterrence is more than just nuclear deterrence, particularly now today. It is non-kinetic, space, cyber. It is your conventional piece of this. All of this has to be integrated together. It's not just a STRATCOM job. It is all combatant commands. And we have to be able to rethink the way we do business.
And U.S. Space Force Commander General Jay Raymond.
Since the 50s, the Air Force has been a leader in the national security space enterprise. Giants like General Schriever, Hardinger, Katina, Generals Horner, Ashy, Estes, Myers, Eberhardt, Lord, Chilton, Kaler, Shelton, and Hyten. All Air Force leaders that built the world's greatest national security space enterprise.
This is an unprecedented time in human history, and the American aerospace power story is strong. So listeners, thank you for sharing this time to tune in to the Mitchell Institute Aerospace Studies Aerospace Advantage podcast. To the United States Air Force and Space Force active duty, reserve, Air National Guard, and civilian members, thank you. Thank you for your continued dedication to serving our country. And thank you for all of our guests today for their great insights. And again, Thanks to our listeners for taking the time to listen to our podcast. Next time on the Aerospace Advantage, we're going to explore the history and the current state of the Air Force. Joining us will be a star-studded cast, including former fighter pilot Heather Lucky Penny and bomber pilot Mark Gonzo Gunzinger. And they're going to tell us their side of the story on the F-22 program and the state of the Air Force today. As always, you can join in the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or by visiting us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, fly safe and check six.